Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week we have a challenge almost. How can we convey smells across the ether? The radio waves, now apart from the smell of ether. I'm speaking to Alyssa Harrad about her book Coming to My Senses, A Story of Perfume, Pleasure, and an Unlikely Bride, the title does sound like sort of shades of grey or aromas of grey almost, but I might disappoint some of you by saying that this is not the tenor of the book. It is much more about Alyssa's discovery, belatedly, that perfume, the whole world of perfume and aromas, introduced her to a whole new vocabulary, a whole new art form, which she had hitherto neglected. And she has recently been in New York for, what was it, Sniffalooza?
Sniffapalooza,
which apparently, in the basements of the big city, of the Big Apple, people get together and they sniff, not snort, sniff perfumes and swap notes on classic perfumes. Lisa, tell us, how did you get into sniffing?
Oh, gosh. Well, it took me a long time to start sniffing. I started reading, so I was a very cautious sniffer. So I was doing some very boring freelance work as a writer, which led me to surf the internet, and I stumbled across perfume blogs. I had never thought about anyone being interested in perfume. I didn't know smell was something that you could describe. And so I was fascinated by these gorgeous descriptions, and often very witty, too, that these ladies were writing about the perfumes. And I was also just interested to see people writing very well for free for what seemed like an extremely intelligent, lively audience.
I'm a union member, and the thought of people writing for free horrifies me.
I know,
same time, it seems to be in a good cause. Carry
well,
on.
I guess I had recently completed my PhD, and then I, like many of my colleagues, had not gotten a job, an academic job, since there aren't very many anymore. And so rather than being horrified and thinking, oh my God, I'll never make a living as a writer, I thought, oh, these people are writing for the joy of it, and they're doing it very, very well. They're not sloppy, they're not self-indulgent, they are passionate and obsessed and very funny. And so I sort of fell in love with that whole community even before I fell in love with the perfume itself. But you can only read so many fabulous descriptions before you start going to the department stores and ordering samples online so you can actually smell the stuff.
But you seem to have found a lot of your stuff not actually in the department stores,
exactly,
where modern formulations and industrial chemistry's best efforts are to be found, but in the back drawers of pokey pharmacies
boutiques. Well, all kinds of places. There is a whole niche and artisan world in perfume that's very different from the mainstream commercial world, where everything is sort of focus grouped and market tested to death. And it's a world where not always, but sometimes the quirky and the strange and the old fashioned can thrive, and people sometimes use ingredients that don't really exist commercially anymore because they can only source them in tiny amounts, or because they're actually growing them in their backyard and then distilling them. It's just full. It's a world that's full of people doing things just for the beauty of it.
Well, one omission I noticed, I can't remember if it was in the New Scientist or Smithsonian, they recently had a picture of the biggest lump of ambergris in the world.
Yeah.
And I mean, ambergris is seriously missing in there. And for the Grand Guignol, the idea of half-digested squid turds containing... squid beaks.
I do mention ambergris, but it's sort of the first thing that everybody hears when you start talking about perfume, so I am, frankly, a little bored by the story by now. I mean, ambergris is very, very hard to get a hold of. It's extremely rare. And actually, this guy who wrote a book called Floating Gold just told me that it's supposed to be illegal in the United States, although I know people who sell it openly and use it in their perfumes, so I'm not quite sure what's going on.
Why would it be illegal? I mean, it's
Because it's part of the whale trade.
They don't use it. Yes.
Poop, actually, is what it is. Poop. But it's my understanding was that if you harvested it from the beach instead of the whale, which people did do at the height of the trade, that it was legal. And clearly they're selling it somewhere, or it wouldn't get over here. But I don't know. I don't know what's up with that.
Mm-hmm. One of the other aspects, of course, is mm-hmm. that the good old perfumiers were sort of busy carving glands out of passing mammals, mostly mammals, I presume. Is that still an ingredient?
No. Natural musk, Tonquin musk, which comes from the musk deer, is an ingredient that's widely banned because it's cruel to the deer. Castoreum, which comes from the anal sex of beavers, I just learned scandalously is being used as a flavoring ingredient in some vanilla ice cream.
Anal beaver glands.
That's
a whole new dimension to ice cream.
Well, you know what? It's a smell that's a very rich, leathery smell, and you can kind of imagine that if you used a very tiny amount of it, which is all of these things you use very tiny amounts of, that it might give a depth and a richness and a kind of that brown caramelized flavor. But, you know, I haven't done the research to see whether the claims are true. It's kind of going around the internet right now, and my editor was one of the people that drew my attention to it.
Needs intensive fact-checking then.
It does, because it's an expensive ingredient. I think it's too expensive to use as a flavoring, but I don't really know.
No, I know where there's some beavers, not far from there.
But all these ingredients are still around, but in very, very tiny amounts. You know, somewhere in the world, there's somebody with a storage unit full of these things that are not supposed to exist anymore.
Yeah, apparently it's slightly irrelevant, but before the U.S. signed on to the anti-whaling treaty, they made sure they had a huge stock of whale oil because it's one of the few that works in the vacuum of space.
Oh, wow.
So they stocked up on it before they signed the treaty to make sure, that they could, that presumably the Voyager's cogs would still wear.
Right.
And the outer reaches.
Perfume is kind of like that, too. There are these ingredients. Sandalwood, true sandalwood oil, Mysore sandalwood oil, very, very hard to get in any kind of commercial way because the trees have been over-harvested, mostly for furniture, unfortunately. But, you know, there's a little shop in downtown in Manhattan called Entourage, and they carry a lot of rare oils and absolutes, and they have some very interesting harvesting projects going on. People know about them, and it's a port city. So I once got an email from them saying, someone just walked in off the street with this canister of aged Mysore sandalwood oil, and we're selling it, and there's only, you know, this many milliliters. Yep. So if you want some now,
now is the time.
And there is something kind of charming to me, not so much about those rarities, but about especially the people I know who grow flowers and do this old-fashioned enfleurage with them, where they put them in the fat and let the fat absorb the scent and then distill the fat. That's something that's no perfume company is going to do that. And so they are able to work with flowers that you can't find in a natural form other places. And I just like the sort of dreaminess of that project, you know, just the total non-commercial nature of it, of these people who become so passionate about something.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Alyssa Harrod about her book Coming to My Senses, A Story of Perfume, Pleasure, and an Unlikely Bride. We'll come on to the bride bit later. We'll get them all excited. 50 aromas of grey or whatever. But one of the points about perfume, you discovered it, and it was a surprise to me. It was one of the reasons I picked up the book and was interested, was it's a whole art form. When they sent that stuff off on the Voyager, they sent paintings, they sent works of literature, they sent music. I don't believe they sent any perfume samples.
No, perfume is one of the many things that is devalued because it's both commercial and mass-produced and because it's feminine.
So and it's somewhat ephemeral as well.
Yes, ephemerality is a huge thing. Although it's been really interesting for me to see the way that food and wine have become elevated over the past 10 or 15, 20 years into something that resembles an art form and that's treated as something that has its own history and its own story. You can collect wine, and that's a very respectable thing to do. But and wine especially is a good parallel because it's all just fragrant alcohol. It all comes from the same alchemical root in history, these things, alcohol and perfume and medicine.
Alcohol was, in fact, from the Arabic word for coal.
Mm-hmm.
When they distilled antimony.
Yes, exactly.
So it was eyeliner.
Yes. Yes, it all has this root in the place where magic meets science, right? Mm-hmm. But perfume is for women, primarily, in the West, although it has a very different history in the East. And it's ephemeral, and it's mass-produced. And so, like many things that are mass-produced and ephemeral and for women, it doesn't seem to gather a history around it, although it has a fascinating one.
Well, they were talking about some of the very first trade groups. If you remember in The Life of Brian,
mm-hmm.
Now skip the mayor next time when they come with it.
Right.
The three wise men brought myrrh and frankincense and the gold on the side.
I was just going to say that's always the example I give to people, that when the three wise men brought those gifts, it was the frankincense that was the real, you know, powerhouse. The gold, And the myrrh was mostly medicinal at that point. It was really frankincense that was the currency, this sort of sensual and scent and spiritual currency of that world.
It goes, certainly, you mentioned an archaeologist who had been studying how far back. We know, for example, that I believe alcohol goes back before 9,000, before cultivation, in fact.
Yeah.
People were making booze on a regular basis. In fact, there's one archaeologist I've been trying to get on the program who is firmly convinced that agriculture actually developed to meet the needs of the brewing tank, because you couldn't gather the stuff spasmodically. If you wanted regular booze, you had to have regular crops.
I completely believe that. I know that they discovered perfume bottles on Cyprus that were 5,000 years old. Probably we've had some kind of scented oil as long as we've had the technology to gather flowers and fragrant things and try to capture their aroma.
So you have visions of sort of Neanderthal woman rubbing lilies behind their ears.
Absolutely. That sort of thing, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I think it's just an integral part of who we are. And it really isn't so much, I think in the United States, people are obsessed with being clean and odorless in many ways. It's a very sterile culture. And so,
have you traveled on a crowded number one train at peak hour recently?
Well, maybe that's why they're obsessed.
Yes. Okay.
But in general, right, there's this effort to shower all the time and to be very clean. And so when I talk to a lot of people, they think of perfume as something that covers over odor. But in fact, that's not what it does most of the time, or didn't start out doing. It started out actually ornamenting the odors that were already there and enhancing them and kind of framing them. So it was about connecting to our animal selves, and then also about prayer, because it was about incense. And always that smoke has been a connection, a way to send a message to the heavens that's sweet and fragrant and acceptable to the gods.
Yes, I remember they always used to call the old high Episcopalian people the stinks and skirts. There's a sort of connection there, which we won't explore at the moment, but still. But with perfume, one of the points, and it must be the difficulty with the vocabulary, and a lot of us just probably aren't even equipped on an olfactory way, that of all of our senses, it is the most sensitive, isn't it? It only takes, you know, there are smells that one molecule will hit the button, sort of thing.
Oh, sure, yeah. I think it's also something that we feel very vulnerable about, because you can't not smell something. I mean, you can sort of pinch your nose and turn away from it, but it is very invasive. It's extremely intimate. And if you don't like something, the disgust is immediate, because it bypasses your language brain and just goes straight to that part of your brain.
Of course, one of the reasons why we evolved it. If you were about to put something in your mouth and it was
absolutely
a little off, you wanted to know pretty damn quickly.
Right away. And also, if there was a fire, you wanted to run before you had to think about it and describe the scent to yourself. But it's also something that we don't have much of a cultural language for, at least in the West. And so it remains a very private thing. I always say, people say there's no official language for smell, and that's sort of true. But what I like to say is that we all have a private internal vocabulary of smell. We have this bank of memories. You know, we remember the scarf that our mother wore that smelled like her perfume and her hair.
And Proust and the Madeleines and the asparagus and all the rest of it.
Yeah, we remember that particularly stinky corner on Broadway before we go down into the subway, and, you know, all of these little moments, and we collect them. And so then when we smell new things, that's what we're comparing the new sensation to, is this bank of memories that we have. But we feel really odd, or most of the people I speak to feel very strange saying those memories out loud, because they're very private.
In a way, it reminded me of some types of music, you know,
mm-hmm.
say, you know, the Rites of Spring, which I happened to be playing yesterday.
Uh-huh.
It's, you know, where you have the music is deliberately intended to evoke particular images and feelings. It's not just an abstraction. And you're saying that perfumers are actually, in your book, you describe how they've tried to recreate the same particular scenes and ambiances.
Yeah, well, perfume has its own professional vocabulary and history. So perfumes often cite perfumes that have come before, or they riff off of them, just in the same way that musicians do, right? The musicians have a bank of things that they're drawing from. But many people are much more familiar with the history of music than they are with the history of perfume. So we're always coming into perfume as new, untutored people. And the only thing we have to understand the perfume with is our own personal memories.
But don't you fall into the parodiable trap of some of the, when you listen to some of the wine tasters,
oh, of course.
And you
hear
their pretentious soarings, and you think, you don't think, oh, I must try that. You think, what a load of taurine excreta that was.
I did have a very funny conversation with a friend of mine. None of my friends like perfume, and none of them even blow dryers. You know, we're a very kind of down-to-earth crew. And so I had to sort of seduce each of my friends into this stuff so that they wouldn't think I was totally crazy. So I was leading one of my friends through a perfume that I was having her try, and I was saying, now this opens with this kind of very bracing, resinous note, and then I let some time pass, and I said, okay, now smell it again, and you'll smell that this like dark rose has kind of opened up behind it. And she smelled her wrist again, and she said, oh, it really does change. I thought you were just making that part up. And I think that whenever you are obsessed with something and you have a specialized vocabulary, the capacity for pretension is very high. But I love the specialized
vocabulary. Being aware of the potential is one of the best defenses, the best prophylactics against it, in a sense.
You know, but I love specialized vocabularies in general. I used to read my father's old jazz LP albums, you know, these essays written clearly by somebody who just came home from the club and has been toking up all night. I couldn't understand a word of it, but I could tell people were passionate, and I was learning all these crazy new words. And I'll read about shipbuilding. I'll read anything. To me, it's just the same as reading poetry, you know. So I kind of glory in being baffled like that, and that was really part of the appeal for me. I have a high tolerance for
I'm
that
glad
kind
you
of
read about shipbuilding. One of our recent guests was Stephen Ujifusa, about the builder of the USS of the United States. So, you know, all human life is here.
Yeah,
steel sinks. No, this isn't just a book about the perfume. It's also about your sort of discovery of perfume and your transformation from, basically, you're describing yourself as a sort of feminist, blue stocking, perfume scorning.
And
moving into this whole new sensorama.
Yeah.
Sniffapalooza.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about perfume is that there is really no need for it in the world. Its only reason for being is that it's a luxurious, beautiful thing that makes people happy. And
that's a fairly potent reason. If that were the only reason I existed, I'd be quite a happy person, but
well,
never mind.
This is what I have come to believe as well. But I think at the time that I discovered it, I had spent a long time trying to be someone who could help mend the world in some way. I had worked in a psych hospital for a couple of years. I had written a dissertation about trauma. I had started some public programs for young girls. You know, I was kind of, I was never a very good activist because I just was too interested in things.
Please, it would be going beyond parody. There's an earthquake in Indonesia. Let's ship emergency packs of perfume off to them and share them off.
Well, no, I mean, that's the thing, is that I was always getting distracted by complexity and beauty, and, you know, so I never had what it took to sort of really grab a hold of an issue and just stick with it. And I was always berating myself for that. And also I had this pesky thing where I sort of wanted to be a writer, which involves having some tolerance for beauty and frivolousness and a waste of time and maybe not knowing it.
And culture managers without any tolerance for beauty or truth or anything at all. But I'll give you a pass on that.
All
okay.
Right. But no, I mean, well, this is, there's actually a great quote from, do you know Leonora Carrington, the surrealist? She wrote a very funny book called The Hearing Trumpet. And in the beginning of The Hearing Trumpet, she says, I don't understand why these novelists are always apologizing for what they do. You don't see the people who start wars apologizing for what they do. You know? So I think the short form of it is that I was just very, very earnest.
I have a friend, Colin Ross, who was the British diplomat on the UN's Iraq Sanctions Committee.
Uh-huh.
And his innovation, it was to decide to start playing good music to calm everybody down during the meeting.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So, you know, I think you should perhaps be prepared to offer your services as a consultant, you know, sort of a little dab of something or other on Sergei Lavrov's ear as he comes into the meeting.
You are joking, but at Davos, the perfumer Christophe Laramiel actually created a series of scents to scent for ambient scenting in the different conference rooms to represent different countries and also to, I guess it was supposed to help them discuss certain things. I was never really sure whether it worked out or not.
It's a nice idea, but it seems to be a bit of a stretch.
I don't know. You'll have to ask the people who were at Davos that year.
Tell us more about your voyage, because part of this was your voyage down the aisle as well, which seemed to take an awful long time. I mean, most people now, you either don't bother getting married or you sort of say, hey, when's the next slot at City Hall? Let's get down there.
Well, I think I'm actually not unusual in my generation for sort of not getting married for a long time and then one day waking up and thinking, hey, I think it's maybe time to make this official. I think for us it was getting to a certain age where we realized how deeply we were connected to our families. I think we had thought of ourselves as individuals and people who had sort of left home for a long time. And then we got to a certain age where we realized that was just a fiction. And so we decided to not only get married, but to have a big wedding so that everyone could come and we could thank them with the big party. And all these people could be in the same place and the same time for what would be the only moment that that was ever going to happen. So I was fine with all of that. But I forgot that I would have to be the star of that production. And I just was really unprepared for how powerful that bride story was. Partly because I'm not really a rebel. And so I didn't want to just like go down the aisle in jeans. I really wanted to give all these people who were coming quite some distance to celebrate with us, I wanted to give them what they were looking for. You know, I wanted to look like a bride. But I couldn't figure out how to do that without giving up all the things that made me me. So while I was navigating that, that's a big part of why I became so obsessed with the perfume.
Your bridal shower, as I remember.
Just one.
Okay. But you know, you had multiple organizers.
I had multiple organizers, yes. Ladies waiting for
me. We Northeasterners believe in collectivities. The individualist Southerners. So very pleased to know about this. But I mean, it was more of a perfume cloud than a bridal shower, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, perfume became for me a kind of a back door into this girly world that had sort of scared me, and also that I had maybe been a little contemptuous of because I was scared. So it kind of got me in the side door, and then once I was in, it became a way for me to connect to my mother and her friends and even my grandmother, and to really understand these women in a way that I hadn't before. Because I hadn't been someone who loved those feminine things. And now I do, and I understand why they love them, and I understand the whole world of ritual that takes place around them.
I think you, at the end, you sort of sum all of this up, so I think as a writer, you can be a reader. Give us a rendition of your final paragraph, which I quite liked.
A woman, I think we can all agree, should smell like herself. But which self? I will smell of honey and roses and saffron, of cloves and vanilla and sandalwood, of vetiver and leather and big white flowers, of summer plums and my own warm skin. I will smell of forests and of earth and of the sea and many, many other things, because I am no longer so sure of who I am and what I have to do, and because I don't know what's coming next.
Well, I quite like that. I often feel like that after. I'm not quite sure who I am after my passion on Rambus has indulged.
Yeah.
But that's different.
This whole chapter is about the question of, you know, what should a woman smell like, which is a ridiculous question. There should be no should in that, no. in that sentence. But it is very much about identity.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskills Review of Books, and we've come to the end of the perfume bottle with Alyssa Harrad about her book Coming to My Senses, a story of perfume, pleasure, and an
Listen in
ride.
Next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.